So should we start this deposition, or do you boys just want to hand us a big bag of money?
Big bag of money.
I think you guys are making a big mistake. I do mostly tax laws and probate stuff occasionally. I got my law degree in night school.
Well, that's fine, Lewis. You got arrested at night.
Now, are you going somewhere with this counselor?
No, not really. I just wanted to upset the witness, Your Honor.
Looks like you did it.
I did it, yeah.
That is a lucid, intelligent, well-thought-out objection.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Overruled.
4 short weeks ago, I was driving truck. Now I'm sitting on the highest court in the land. Thanks to the George Bush Home Study Course, you two could be a Supreme Court Justice.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 552. I'm Thomas. That's Andrew. How are you doing, sir?
I will tell you, it's been a rough day, but listened to the intro quotes on the new ones. And man, are they just the chef's kiss.
Money.
They're so good. So good. So I'm back up to being Mr. Fantastic. Aww.
Well, that's nice. I'm glad we could do that for you.
Yeah,
that's
you did
awesome.
A great job.
It's always fun. Patrons do a great job of suggesting them. And after I do them, I end up hearing from a bunch of people who are like, oh, do this one. And it's like, well, sorry, too late. But, you know, everybody, make sure to submit it next time and vote on the ones you like. It's a super fun thing. If anything, we should probably change them more often so we get to do that more. But that's okay. In other news, Andrew, we've got a lot of awful movies I want to mention here at the outset. It is a long edit. It went very long. I'm surprised. The movie is... Physical
the
evidence.
The movie is nothing.
We can at least tease it. I'll get it edited and out within a few days, I hope. But if you want to watch it first, it's a delightful,
terrible watch. You don't want to watch it first.
Physical evidence.
It's free on Amazon Prime. And,
it's the right price. Yeah.
Yeah, that is indeed price to move. Yeah, it's a Burt Reynolds,
Teresa
Russell
movie. It's still not a great deal
at
that price, but it's, you know. It's Burt Reynolds.
It is Burt Reynolds. So there you go.
And it's an hour and 39 minutes or something like that. And we did a 2 hour and 39 minute lamb about it.
Yep.
That I
yes,
will
we
hopefully
did.
Edit down. So look forward to that, patrons. It's a lot of fun. We're back to our old Lot Awful Movies hijinks for this month. Can't wait.
Oh, that was a lot of fun. I will tell you, we had a good time doing that one. Little bit more on the pre-show news. Obviously, we have listeners who are in Kentucky who are potentially subject to the, I don't know why they keep calling them the quad state tornadoes. I think it's hit like 6 different states. But if you've been subject to the severe weather, you know, obviously our hearts go out to you. Make sure, you know, you're safe. You let us know that you're safe. That's pretty serious stuff. And related to that, this is going to come out on the 17th. This is when people are making their holiday travel plans and visitation plans. And we've got the Omicron variant. You cannot be too safe. And if there is something that feels like, well, you know, like Uncle Frank really hasn't seen the kids. And be smart, be safe, travel
Keep
smart.
Uncle Frank's away from your kids, everybody. That's just me.
It is.
Don't take family advice from a Thomas.
It's tough, and it's super tough at the holidays. That's when you get the most pressure. But if a gathering feels weird, don't do it. I don't want to be a downer, but we do owe it to our listeners to say travel safe and gather safe. I want to end on a high note, last kind of pre-show note. Again, I have to be a little bit oblique about these things, but I spoke this morning to another member of Congress, and we may be moving towards draft legislation on Christian health share ministries.
Need any help with that, or you got it?
I will bring you in.
Okay, well, I'm here. I'm just letting you know my pen is available.
good. And again, I just want to say, if you were a listener, if you sent in stories, my gosh, the listeners who sent in actual documents, like you helped make this happen. So if we get potential legislation and there are a bunch of options that are being considered, know that you played a part in that. I'm so proud of the show and our community and our listeners, and thank you all.
It's been an honor serving with you all. Autobots,
Roll out.
As we are recording, this news came out this morning that the Biden administration is going to shelve efforts to pass the Build Back Better Act. We've described all of the very good things that are in that act to pivot to passing voting rights legislation. And I want to unpack all of that. But first, I want to say this. This goes against every bit of political conventional wisdom that there is. And I want to articulate what that is, you know, as somebody with an undergraduate degree in political communications, the conventional wisdom, what a traditional politician would do, who is at 43% in the polls right now, which is where the polling average of Joe Biden is. Now, that's ridiculous, but nevertheless, that's where it is. And that is on the back of fickle voters in the center, the kind of people who are like, well, you know, gas prices are high and they said inflation and he hasn't done anything in a couple of months. And so, you know, I'm unhappy. And the conventional wisdom is you pump up those numbers by getting something popular done. And that then gives you the political capital to do something that is more niche, that is harder to understand. That was the plan with Build Back Better. By punting on that, Joe Biden is doing, if you are a critic to the left of Joe Biden, like this show, he's doing what you want him to do. He is giving up on a package that is potentially broadly popular with the center and with mainstream, not just Democrats, but independents, in favor of something that is much more important, but is an incredibly niche issue. And I know it. I mean, Thomas, I love it when you sort of will encounter things in the political sphere that just sort of remind us of just how inside baseball the show is, right? Like 80% of America cannot define what the filibuster is. When you talk about voting rights, that is not a pandering issue. That is a base issue.
I don't even know if it's anything that, I mean, I guess it's an issue kind of to rally people, but it also is more just like giving those people the ability to vote for you. You know, it's something that you may not even need to tell anybody about necessarily to still have a good effect on your chances.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's right. And so the act that will be taken up, that is sort of the tip of the spear here, is Senate Bill 2747, the Freedom to Vote Act. Among its co-sponsors are one, Joe Manchin from West Virginia. It is easy, and therefore we do hate on Joe Manchin. But as I go through and describe this bill, I will tell you, cut to the chase, we wrung our hands about Joe Manchin and the, like, you know, well, the spending's got to be less and this and that. And Joe Manchin, you absolutely should describe him as a centrist, as center right on spending issues. He is mainstream left on voting issues. The bill that he has co-sponsored, as I go through, there is nothing that I find objectionable about this bill. If you want to pull stuff out, you can pull out the, like, you know, there's got to be paper ballot trails and stuff like that as responding to imaginary concerns. And that's true. But again, I don't have a problem with better accountability with our electronic voting systems, even if it is not a you know, even if the you know, big lie is a manufactured big lie in 2020. That's the only thing that you could criticize. Otherwise, this bill falls into three key areas that are almost everything that would want to be on your wish list as a left member of the Democratic Party.
Are they ending gerrymandering?
They include provisions about voting, provisions about redistricting, and provisions about campaign finance. There's a bunch of other stuff in there too, but those are the three main areas. So you want to talk gerrymandering? Let's go to that one first. Let's go to redistricting. Yes, so do I. So this is Title V of the legislation of S-2747. Again, we'll link it in the show notes. It does a lot of things about gerrymandering, but the biggest comes from Section 5003C, subsections 1 and 2. And I'm going to start reading that to you. 5003C1 says, prohibition. A state may not use a redistricting plan to conduct an election that, when considered on a statewide basis, has been drawn with the intent or has the effect of materially favoring or disfavoring any political party.
Wow. That's pretty plain language there.
That's pretty plain, pretty great language as far as I'm concerned.
As a textualist, I think that will mean you can't gerrymander, right?
That is
Neil Gorsuch will have to say.
Yeah. And so then you might say, okay, what's the point behind that drawn with the intent or has the effect mm-hmm. of materially disfavoring?
Yeah. I was wondering why not just the effect of?
Yep. So the first is that it has to do with the kind of evidence that the court will consider, right? So if you just say has the effect of, then being able to introduce evidence of like, you know, dipshit Republican state representative, like, well, you know, this is going to help advantage. Wink, wink, non-Hispanic whites, all of a sudden now you can introduce that evidence in and the court can consider it.
Gotcha.
And then materially favoring or disfavoring any political party, what does that mean? Well, that is then defined in the next section of the legislation. It says determination of effect. The determination of whether a redistricting plan has the effect of materially favoring or disfavoring a political party shall be based on an evaluation of the totality of the circumstances, which at minimum shall involve consideration of each of the following factors. And then there are four factors that they set forth. So A, computer modeling based on relevant statewide general elections for federal office held over the 8 years preceding the adoption of the redistricting plan, setting forth the probable electoral outcomes for the plan under a range of reasonably foreseeable conditions. Okay. This is taken directly from plaintiffs' experts in litigation challenging gerrymandered districts over the past 5 years. We have finally caught up. We've talked about the red map, and you can just kind of plug in the numbers. And so our experts on the side of breaking that down have then, for example, one of the things that came up in the Wisconsin legislation was plaintiffs' expert ran, you know, 100,000 Monte Carlo simulations mm-hmm. and was like, well, in 99,999 of these, the Republicans had less power than the plan that you've adopted.
We've got some Doctor Strange level stuff there. I've seen 14 million futures of districting, and there's only one that is as unfair for Democrats as this one.
That's exactly right. And so this specifically would say by law, use that kind of analysis. You look at the last
eight
years of history.
Oh, wow, we have to use Dr. Strange. Oh, geez. Okay. Yeah.
So
he's not even American. We're going to, all right. Well, okay. If that's what we need to do, Andrew, I think we should do that. Benedict Cumberbatch, you got a new full-time job.
I'm sorry to tell Benedict Cumberbatch that he's going to be enlisted.
This terrible American accent. No gerrymandering, everybody here.
B, an analysis of whether the redistricting plan is statistically likely to result in partisan advantage or disadvantage on a statewide basis, the degree of such advantage or disadvantage, and whether such advantage or disadvantage is likely to be present under a range of reasonably foreseeable electoral conditions. Okay, that's the kind of standard numerical analysis. C, and this I'm going to read you the really, really important part. A comparison of the modeled electoral outcomes for the redistricting plan to the modeled electoral outcomes for alternative plans that comply with this section in order to determine whether reasonable alternatives exist that would result in materially lower levels of partisan advantage or disadvantage on a statewide basis. And then this is the key language. For purposes of this subparagraph, alternative plans considered may include both actual plans proposed during the redistricting process and other plans prepared for purposes of comparison. So again,
so we can make them. We can be like, look, this one would be way more fair.
Yeah. Taken from the way in which these cases have been litigated and the kinds of evidence that has been shockingly persuasive, except, you know, not to the Supreme Court. And then D, any other relevant information, including how broad support was for the redistricting plan among members of the entity responsible for developing and adopting the plan, and whether the processes leading to the development and adoption of the plan were transparent and equally open to all members of the entity and to the public. So yes, that means all the Republicans got together and in a room and like sprung this on the legislature and Democrats weren't invited, which is how these plans get crammed through Republican state legislatures, would then be evidence that the plan has been drawn with the intent of advantaging the Republican Party.
That all sounds really good.
Does it not sound good? Let me add one more really, really good thing, and that is In the procedural section, right, how this gets implemented, there is both, it permits the attorney general to bring a civil action for relief to say, oh, hey, I've just looked at what's going on in Pennsylvania and I'm going to sue them. Or it allows any citizen of a state who is aggrieved by the failure of the state to meet the requirements of the Constitution or federal law, including this law, with respect to their redistricting, may bring a civil action in the United States District Court for the applicable venue for such relief as may be appropriate to remedy the failure to do so. Okay. So in other words, if I'm a voter and I live in the district, I can bring a lawsuit challenging that redistricting. And the procedures expedite consideration of the case. They allow me to bring that case in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia if I think it's going to be a favorable, you know, a more favorable forum. And it mandates, I love, again, you know, you want to talk about a little bit of hardball. This is section 5006A6. It says a final decision, right, by the district court shall be reviewable on appeal by the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Huh. There shall be no right of appeal in such proceedings to any other court of appeals. Such appeal shall be taken within 10 days. A final decision of the Court of Appeals may be reviewed by the Supreme Court by writ of certiorari.
I thought it was writing out the Supreme Court, but then the last thing.
No, there are other areas that are silent as to whether they're writing out the Supreme Court. I don't think you want to try and put jurisdiction stripping in here as well.
Yeah.
But think about what this does. What this means is that in states that have a history of gerrymandering, particularly for racial or for partisan advantage, you now are not going to the conservative courts of appeal that sit above those states, right? This will not be reviewed by the Fifth Circuit or the 11th Circuit. It will be reviewed on appeal by the DC Circuit. And that's huge. Negatron might want to say, okay, but what's to stop the Supreme Court from just coming in and overturning everything? The answer is there are too many of these cases, right? It would be too much. Could they jump in and overturn one or two by putting them on the, they could do that.
So someone challenges a gerrymandered thingy, they win.
Right.
And then it goes to the
Supreme
Court.
Could the Supreme Court reverse it? Yeah.
And they just reverse on a naked power grab that would know, because there's no possible justification. Right. I mean,
not a legal one. Language. Yeah. No. Right.
First off, obviously we'll have to talk about the filibuster and all that. I'll leave that aside for now and say, let's say we do get this bill passed. That would be amazing. Would it be in time for the midterms?
Yes, it would be in time for the midterms.
Would that, though, it's cutting it a little close, as the great Dr. Venkman says in Ghostbusters 2. Cutting it a little close. Would that be justification for the Supreme Court to be like, you know what? Yeah, sure, the law is great. We get it. You know, great law. Good job. But a little too close for this midterm. So we're going to say you don't have to do it for this upcoming election. Is that a possibility?
So could they enjoin the entire law from going into effect prior to the midterms? They could, but I will tell you that this law is written with severability clauses and contains enough discrete subject matter cases that strikes me as unlikely, right? Even with this hyper-partisan Supreme Court. Now, you know, is there a bar so low Amy Coney Barrett cannot crawl under it? I mean, you know, but
we'll see.
We will see. This expressly reiterates 60 times that it applies to the 2022 elections. So
really? Okay.
Yeah. So it is meant to take effect. And as we talk about, you know, some of the things, it is also very clearly meant to supersede things like the Georgia voter disenfranchisement law, right? So
did they actually call it that?
Well, let's start. So we talked about one major area, which was redistricting. A second major area that this addresses is access to voting.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to talk about five specific things that it does, which again, comprise pretty much the entirety of my wish list. So number one, every state must have automatic voter registration, including over the internet and same day voter registration.
Oh my God. Wow. That's awesome.
Number two, every state must have universal vote by mail, right? Ooh. This is section D311A1. If an individual in a state is eligible to cast a vote in an election for federal office, right? So not have that right rescinded by being a felon, right? An ex-felon. Now, we should fix that. But, you know,
I'm
one
not
thing
looking
at a
gift mansion in the mouth.
Yeah, right. If an individual in a state is eligible to cast a vote, the state may not impose any additional conditions or requirement on the eligibility of the individual to cast the vote in such election by absentee ballot by mail. Period. End of sentence.
I never knew I could have this kind of reaction to proposed legislation, Andrew. This is, I'm getting a little flushed. I gotta, I'm gonna mute for a minute.
I think you should. While Thomas is mute, I'm gonna add to that. The state can't require you to show ID or have a valid. driver's license in order to vote
the
by mail.
Meme or whatever.
Right, right. The way in which they throw out mail-in votes is by signature matching. This legislation says if they use signature matching, they must have due process in which you are informed as soon as possible, but within one day that you are. So, wow. I guess same day they could also inform you as soon as possible, but within one day that your signature has been unmatched and you have the opportunity to come in and cure that deficiency. If they don't provide those procedures, they cannot throw out ballots on the you know, well, we looked and this signature doesn't look exactly like the one on your driver's license from 1989, right? They can't do that trick anymore.
This sounds too good to be true.
I've got more. Universal early voting of at least 15 days in every state, with the polls open at least 10 hours a day, and Election Day is a federal holiday.
Sorry, did I hear that right? Election Day is a federal holiday?
Yeah.
Wow. I was actually going to ask that earlier, but I thought it was too good to be true, so I didn't.
Still more. But wait, there's more. Outlawing what I would call voter suppression dirty tricks. So one of them are like, this process is called voter caging. This is what Ohio did, but other states have followed suit. That is, a government agency will like send out a card, right? And be like, hey, you've got to send this card back in 11 days. And if you don't send in the card, then you get put on a list. And the list says, well, you know,
we assume you hate voting and will never do it again.
Right. And then they use that to cage voters as being ineligible. You can't do that from any other government agency. So you can still have, and believe me, like whatever's left here, Republicans will, you know, seep like water to fill those gaps. You can still test to see that the state election commission can test to see if you live somewhere, but they cannot rely on other state agencies to create a list of ineligible voters. That has been the practice of voter caging. Also, when it comes to purging voters off the rolls, it expressly directs. It says if somebody doesn't live in a district anymore, they may be purged. But for purposes of purging, after you send out a notice, the following factors or any combination thereof shall not be treated as objective and reliable evidence of a registrant's inability to vote. A, the failure of the registrant to vote in any election. B, the failure of the registrant to respond to any election mail unless the election mail has been returned as undeliverable. And C, the failure of the registrant to take any other action with respect to voting in any election or with respect to the registrant's status as a registrant. And so again, I don't underestimate the power of Republican scumbags to come through. But what this says is if you're going to declare somebody ineligible, they have to be not receiving their mail at the address where you try and contact them. You cannot just say, well, they didn't return these six cards or they didn't register in the last election, so they probably don't care about ever voting again. These are not valid reasons for purging somebody from the voter rolls.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and declare this as a fantastic bill. I know I'm sure there's more amazing stuff, but I think maybe we need to take the time to talk about how this could possibly happen, right?
We should. Before we do that, I just want to say the fifth category includes prohibiting denying food to people in line, among other things. Of voter intimidation. So when you say,
I hope
this
the language
crafted,
is like, can't believe we need to write this down.
It kind of does. There is subtitle 8, preventing restrictions on food and beverages at polling stations. Wow. And it says, allowing volunteers to donate food and water to all people waiting in line, regardless of their political preference and without engaging in electioneering activities, helps ensure Americans who face long lines at their polling place can still exercise their constitutional right to vote without risk of dehydration, inadequate food, discomfort, and risks to health. So, yeah. It's clear where this is taking aim. With respect to your question, how does this pass? This passes with the same kind of procedure, however specifically narrowly tailored, that you would use in blowing up the filibuster, right? Which is, they're one of two options. You can move to suspend the rules, or you can appeal to the decision of the chair with respect to the amount of time left to debate. And in both cases, you would need exactly 50 votes plus the vote of the vice president.
Sorry, I should have clarified. I know that a hypothetical body of 50 people who wanted to do this could do it. We have to play by Manchin's, try not to curse, family show. we have to play by Manchin's conceptions of what is okay. And is there a way to pass this that you think, in your opinion, I guess, will be okay with him? Because it's one thing to say, he sponsors it. Great. Awesome.
Yeah, this is cool. His bill.
But we've seen this before. I mean, we've seen things where it's like, okay, Manchin, go get your Republicans who are going to vote for you. And in the past, from my memory, it's like, those don't go anywhere. Yes, he supports it, but if he can't get Republicans to vote for it, which he absolutely will not be able to on this, what's your prediction on what he will do?
My prediction on what he will do is, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I am going to be, I'm going to redon the mantle of Optimist Prime.
Wow.
And I think that you would have to be incompetent at a level that I do not think you could attribute to Joe Biden. I will tell you, there is some very weird procedural weirdness in terms of the last time this bill came up for a cloture vote. And cloture is the vote that is to shut off debate that requires 60 votes. It was 51-49. And 49 Democrats, 50 Republicans, and one Democrat. And if I asked you, which Democrat do you think voted against cloture to keep this open? Knowing, well, by the way, it's obviously not Manchin.
Sounds
it's
like
obviously
not
Sinema.
And well, I wouldn't have said obviously not Sinema, but okay.
Because that would have made this too easy for you.
Wait, when was this?
This vote was taken October 20th, so just about 2 months ago.
I can't come up with, I don't know. I can't come up with like what this would be based on if it's not those two people.
Yep.
Tester? I don't know.
So literally, I think you could get through the entire Senate without coming up with Chuck Schumer.
Wow.
And so when I say procedural weirdness, this is, hey, we intend to revisit this.
So is it a way to keep it alive or something? Or
when you vote no on cloture, what that means is you want to keep the legislation open so that we can continue to debate it. And that's what Schumer's vote did.
I guess I don't understand, because I thought you said it needed 60 votes anyway.
It does. So by doing that, it certainly could have been 50-50. That's not 3/5. That fails.
Right. But it's just protecting in case the Republicans do shenanigans or something? Or
I am not an expert on Senate parliamentary procedure, but that is what I would infer. Right?
Okay.
That in other words, right? Like, we know Chuck Schumer wants this bill passed. We know he supports it. We know that there's not a problem for support for the bill from Sinema and Manchin. And now the question is Joe Manchin willing to carve out the narrowest possible exception to the filibuster, right? To say, okay, when it comes to this particular bill, we will appeal to the decision of the chair, right? Like, maybe this is part of how you set that up, is Chuck Schumer says, I made a mistake. I voted on the wrong side. And by the way, I want to ask the question, if I switch, right? This isn't one of those 3/5-y things, is it? And then the chair will say, yes, this is a 3/5-y thing. And then you can say, okay, motion to appeal to the decision of the chair, and say, as it turns out, after all, this isn't one of those 3/5-y things. Again, that's a bit of a hypothetical. But I don't think that Joe Biden would publicly announce, this is what we're going to do, without having thought about and talked about and got some reassurances from Joe Manchin that this is something not just that he would vote for in the abstract, but really move and allow us to pass.
Don't you get my hopes up. Don't you dare get my hopes up, Andrew.
Well,
this would be huge. I mean, this would be, this bill is the first thing I've heard that sounds like it's truly meeting the moment. I'm not saying that this, that they, that the Democrats haven't done other great things. They have. Yep. They've done other great things. This feels like we're finally doing something to maybe, if we pass this, to combat the descent into fascism, doesn't it?
It absolutely feels that way. And again, you want to label me as cautiously optimistic and ready to be smacked down in 2 weeks? I think that's the position I want to take.
Will it only take 2 weeks? Is that the schedule they're setting for themselves?
Again, this is within the context of the self-imposed deadline for Build Back Better was end of the year. It would surprise me if the Democrats went the entirety of this session with nothing legislatively to show for anything.
Not impossible.
I guess you hear that in my voice. There's lots of ways in which this could go badly. But again, the bottom line is this, right? If you are a left-wing critic of Joe Biden, this is the thing that you said he hasn't been doing.
And it's maybe the most, one of the most important.
It absolutely could be the most important. Crucial.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maybe there is the combination of he's listening to us and also recognizes like, hey, I've got to go all in here, right? Like,
I think it might just be based on the Manchin math, right? Yeah. I mean, it sounds like we're hostages to these a-holes, Manchin and Sinema. And if this is something that perhaps Biden has gotten some assurances from Manchin that could happen, maybe that's why the change of plan.
That seems very, very plausible to me. Again, it seems implausible that you would spring this on Joe Manchin, right?
At this point, I hope we will have learned to not spring anything on Joe Manchin.
Right.
He's not afraid to shoot it down easily. Yeah.
He's an old white dude with a gun. Like, let's not scare him.
Gosh. So, but just I just want to clarify because it's a complex issue, just to make sure we all are on the same page here. There is no one weird trick around the filibuster. And by that, I mean, like, you can't pass this any other way but doing some sort of filibuster carve out, right?
Correct. There is it is both the strength and the weakness, right? This is not a budget reconciliation thing, which would then expire within a maximum of 10 years, right? This is a change to the law for all time. Right. Does it fix everything? Yeah. No. Like, for example, we have the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, which the Democratic Senate should also take up, which would restore Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act of 1965 and require preclearance before Southern states start imposing restrictions on voting again. There are lots more things to do, but we went through, and I didn't talk about the political campaign stuff. It's a more complex subject anyway, and I will tell you, not as important. Even if all that stuff, now it's interesting the way the bill approaches it. It's good stuff, but even without any of that, I mean, you heard what I read to you. This is a great bill.
It really is, yeah.
If we get it passed, it will be a signature legislative accomplishment.
If it had nothing other than just the gerrymandering stuff, it'd be
great. Universal vote by mail. If it was just a universal vote by mail bill, it would be great. Yeah, it's fantastic. So there you go. And let's wait. And again, we're going to hear sneak peek for Tuesday's show, right? Like, we're not afraid to call out Joe Biden when he's done something terrible. And he's done, you know, a terrible thing with the SCOTUS Commission. We're going to tear that apart on next Tuesday's show. If this turns out to just sort of founder and go nowhere, you know, we will be the first on the front lines to say it will be, this is kind of dumb.
It doesn't matter. What's the point in criticizing? Yeah. It doesn't matter. Like, if we don't do this, we don't get to have democracy for much longer. So, okay, I'll yell at Biden. That'll fix. I don't know. Yeah. I'm just sitting here waiting to see if the people in charge are going to let us have more democracy or not. I don't know what we can do about it. They have to pass this.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Wild card! Yeah!
What?
We have time for some news on the 1/6 commission. This is, you've been tweeting a lot about this. I cannot wait to hear the full breakdown, Andrew. What's going on?
John Eastman has sued the 1/6 commission, but really what he is trying to do is block a 1/6 committee subpoena to Verizon for his cell phone records.
Quick question. Can you sue a commission? I didn't even think about that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Okay. Just wondering. Didn't know they could be the named party in a lawsuit.
Yep. And this is, it names Benny Thompson as chairman of the committee. It names John Wood in his official capacity as investigative counsel for the minority members of the House Select Committee to investigate the January 6th attack. So, yeah, it seeks declaratory and injunctive relief. The declaratory relief is that, you know, the 1/6 commission is invalid. The injunctive relief is a temporary restraining order and preliminary injunction, followed by a permanent injunction enjoining Verizon from complying with the subpoena to turn over John Eastman's cell phone records, which include his texts. First, I'm going to cut to the punchline, which is because of the stupidity involved by John Eastman and his lawyers, they may not have gotten any relief here. It is entirely possible that Verizon has already turned over those records, and that would just be delightful and hoisted by their own petard. Let's break down this complaint very, very quickly. And again, we're going to read it the opening arguments way. So first, right, we look at the caption, and I just have to say, like, this is when you first file a complaint, you have a longer caption, right, in which you list the addresses of the people that you're suing. Mm-hmm. And so you have to list that for the plaintiff as well. And it lists John Eastman, care of his lawyers, right? Like, you know, like he's in the goddamn witness protection program or something.
Weird.
You can do that if you have somebody who needs to not disclose where they live, because again, they're in the witness protection program. There is no explanation when it comes to the party section. You would say then in the party section, right? Plaintiff John Eastman is identified as residing at, you know, can be contacted via his attorneys because he reasonably fears for his life, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. There's none of that. It just says, plaintiff John C. Eastman, Dr. Eastman, is a law professor and attorney. Why don't you tell us where he lives then, lawyers? I don't know.
Okay. So that's weird.
So that's it. Yeah, that's weird, right? Then we go, so that's the caption. Then we scroll back all the way down to the bottom. And this is submitted by Charles Burnham of Burnham and Gorakov, PLLC in Washington, D.C. So went to BurnhamGorakov.com and found out that Burnham and Gorakov is a white-collar criminal defense boutique firm. Apparently, they're good at it, especially Gorakov has got a lot of positive testimonials. When you go to their website and you search for Eastman, it pulls up zero hits, despite the fact that they have an active blog and that as a boutique firm, you would think branching out into a thing you don't do is something you would market, right? You'd be like, hey, we also do constitutional law and, you know, responses to congressional subpoena, right? Like that's how you bring in new clients. Unless, of course, you're embarrassed about your client and the arguments that you're making in court, at which point you assiduously scrub any mention of his name from your website. Oh, also, did I mention they blog like every day? Yeah. Anyway.
Wow.
So they hide the fact that they're representing John Eastman. This guy, Charles Burnham, does not do civil litigation. And it kind of shows because they filed this complaint seeking emergency injunctive relief on December 14th. On December 15th, on the docket, the court filed two notices of error, which says the PDF file you docketed contained errors. One, it's missing summonses for the government. When naming a government agent or agency as a defendant, you must supply a summons for each defendant and two additional summonses for the U.S. Attorney and the U.S. Attorney General.
So is this Clippy telling them what?
Yeah, it kind of is, right? Please submit using the event request for summons to issue. Number two, case assignment and nature of suit was not selected on the civil cover sheet, section 4. Please refile using the event civil cover sheet. And a civil cover sheet is literally like, it's a checkbox, right? It's, you know, it's a one-page front back, you got to check, like, is the amount over $75,000? What's the nature of the suit, right? It's the kind of boring stuff you do if you're a civil litigator. You don't have to file them. It's a civil check cover sheet. You don't have to file them in criminal cases. So apparently they're just not used to filing these sorts of things. And then the third error, right, docketed separately, is that your motion for injunctive relief was filed as an attachment and not as a separate entry. That's, again, kind of a basic error because you can easily imagine a court denying an emergency request for an injunction, but saying, I'm still going to listen to your complaint. But the TRO request is denied. And so in order to do that, if it's Exhibit A, and this is what it was Exhibit number 4 to the complaint. If you attach it to the complaint, then the docket will say, motion denied or motion granted with respect to docket number 1, which would then be super confusing because it would look like they were just denying your right to file the complaint or granting your right to file the complaint, which makes no sense. Now, I want to be clear about this. I make errors. Lawyers make errors all the time in electronic filing. You type in the wrong number. You fail to attach the docket. This is not an error with electronic filing. This is not just like an oopsie.
This is not, you sent the email, here's the lawsuit, and then the next email, and here's with it actually attached.
Right. I do that all the time. I have a case right now that it took
everyone has done that. It's impossible to not have done that if you worked at any kind of job like that.
Yeah. You know, I have a case that is consolidated, so there's two separate numbers, and I filed under the latest number, and then the judge, like 3 months later, called me up and was like, hey, can you file under the original, because I consolidated it into the first filed number, and I didn't see this pleading that you filed. And I said, yes, Your Honor, I can do that, right? So look, this is not a glass houses thing. This is the kind of mistake about procedurally what you do when you file civil complaints that you're likely to make if this is not what you do. And this is what he does.
So I was going to say, this is not Kraken lawyers, right?
No. I mean, the arguments are bad, but and I want to get into the quote merits of the argument super briefly. But no, this is just where you are when you are insurrectionist John C. Eastman, that I don't know if this guy Charles Barnum owed him a favor or whatever, but this is not, I would not represent a white collar criminal defendant. Charles Barnum should not be representing somebody who is the subject of a congressional subpoena, right? He should get a professional lawyer who does that sort of thing. And his failure to do so, by the way, that was all docketed yesterday, 2 days ago by the time you hear this, the Wednesday, December 15th, and it said, compliance deadline is by close of business today. This case will not proceed any further until all errors are satisfied. And that's in bold text, right? So, and got emailed to Charles Barnum. As of the date of this recording, when we started, 7 p.m. East Coast time, on the next day, December 16th, there was no correction made to the record. Mm. There was no effort to come into compliance. And I think I know why, because in this complaint, it says that Verizon told them originally the Verizon subpoena was due at the beginning of December, like December 2nd. And then Verizon said, okay, hey, we're going to hold off on complying with the subpoena until December 15th. And if you can give us a court order that says we are not to comply with the subpoena, then we'll, follow that court order. Otherwise, on December 15th, we're going to turn over these records. And that, by the way, as of this recording, was yesterday. So I think the slapdash nature of hiring the white collar crime guy to throw together your lawsuit that you filed on December 14th, which, again, maybe have a little more urgency. Like if I know the hard deadline for Verizon turning over my documents is the 15th of December,
playing it close to the line there.
Maybe file on the 10th. That's right.
That's late even for me. I think I would have finished it by the 13th.
Yeah. So they filed on the 14th. They had errors. They went uncorrected. The court told them to correct it. They didn't do it in time. It is entirely possible the 1-6 committee has the Eastman text messages. Now, what were the arguments? The primary argument raised in the stupid complaint is the 1-6 committee is not a valid congressional committee. It's just out there to discover criminal information, and criminal information is not the kind of thing that Congress Congress is empowered to establish a subcommittee to discover. This is the argument Trump has been making and losing at every level of federal court for years. And it's not, it would not avail John Eastman here. There is no doubt that the 1-6 committee is a valid committee with legitimate legislative powers. That is, to try and make sure that 1-6 never happens again, that they do not have to show, we know this from the Mazar subpoenas, that they do not have to show existing pending legislation. They just have to show this is a thing that Congress is empowered to look at. And by the way, they are allowed to refer matters out to the Department of Justice where they discover criminal activity. And so there's an ostensible smoking gun where they quote Adam Kinzinger to ostensibly show that the committee has an improper purpose, saying, Representative Kinzinger stated in his opening remarks, our mission is very simple, to ensure the trust and ensure accountability. Congress was not prepared on January 6th. We weren't prepared because we never imagined this could happen, an attack by our own people, fostered and encouraged by those granted power through the very system they sought to overturn. I don't know why he thinks that's a smoking gun. that is a valid legislative purpose. And it is clear that this is going nowhere. I suspect this lawsuit will be withdrawn in the next couple of days as moot, because I imagine that the January 6th committee probably has those documents. In the event that it isn't, the lawsuit is a joke. There is, if you get my show notes, if you are a patron at that tier, you can look at the case that I break down that's hilarious that they cite. It's called Yellen v. U.S. And I guess now, you know, any of our listeners could go look at it. This is bad law and bad lawyering, and it couldn't happen to a better person.
All right. Well, just squeeze in one more little update here on Activision. What happened there?
Yep. On December the 13th, there is no written order yet, but at oral arguments on DFA's motion to intervene in the federal case, that judge denied the motion to intervene. We will do a deeper breakdown on why he's just upset. And I'm not surprised at all by this, right? Like, this is what we discussed, that like when you have two government agencies bickering with each other, mm-hmm. a federal judge is very likely to just sort of throw up his hands and be like, you guys figure this the hell out, because it's not up to me to decide whether I'm going to side with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission or, you know, the Department of Fair Employment and Housing. I don't know. And that appears to be what's going on. It does not mean that the court will enter the federal consent decree. They still have to hear, for example, from the union objections, right? And there's still supplemental briefing with respect to that. And it does not mean, even if that consent decree were entered, that DFA is unable to bring and maintain its lawsuit. And in fact, on December 9th, DFA represented in its state lawsuit that it would proceed even if it were not allowed to intervene in the federal case, and even if the EEOC consent decree were entered. So we're continuing to follow. You will see that in the news. Probably wanted to see DFA permitted to intervene, yeah. But it's not surprising that they weren't. It does not necessarily mean that an inadequate settlement will be entered. We will continue to watch.
So don't panic yet.
Don't panic yet. We will tell you when is a perfectly good time to panic. It's a
perfect time to panic. Okay. All right. Well, squeezed a lot in here. Nice work.
Thank you.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. Thomas takes the bar exam. Each and every week, I attempt to answer a question using nothing but the knowledge I've learned listening to this podcast over the years. Let's hear it. Here we go. Coming off a one where I really just kind of tripped over the finish line, so I need to build myself back up here.
Thomas, a man sued his boss in state court alleging claims for non-payment of wages.
Love it.
Under both state and federal law. The man's friend, who was an attorney, advised the man to remove the case to federal court on the basis of federal question jurisdiction because he thought the federal court would be more sympathetic to the man's claim. The man thereafter promptly removed the case to federal court. The man's boss made a timely motion to remand the case back to state court. How will the federal court proceed? A, it will hear the federal claims, but not the state claims. B, it will hear the entire case because it was timely removed and involves a federal question.
What?
C, it will remand the case unless the amount in controversy exceeds $75,000. Or D, it will remand the case to state court.
What the Oh my God. I don't know. Okay. Boy, this is interesting. I don't know what to think about this. So let's make sure we got the facts right. We got a man suing his boss in state court, alleging claims for non-payment of wages. And it says under both state and federal law. Interesting. Then, okay, friendly attorney here. I'm going to just, hopefully, I'll just assume this attorney knows what he's doing. So maybe that'll be how I answer. No. We don't know whether or not this was a good idea, I guess. But removes the case to federal court on the basis of federal question jurisdiction. So federal question jurisdiction seems a little different than maybe what we've talked about in the past. And I'm thinking about that $75,000. I actually, as of now, I think already that's an attractive distractor. I don't know that matters, but I could be wrong. Because we don't have like the divert. This isn't diversity jurisdiction. Because I think that's diversity jurisdiction. Which is you need complete diversity and an amount in controversy above $75,000, I think. And so I think C, I'm already ruling out C, I'm pretty sure. So it's federal question jurisdiction because he thought the federal court would be more sympathetic. The man thereafter promptly removed the case to federal court. Okay, removed it to federal court. The man's boss made a timely motion to remand the case to state court. How will the federal court proceed? So this is probably going to be impossible. There's probably some rules here that I've never heard of about what it shall do here. Let's see if we can puzzle it out and just get lucky. So A, it will hear the federal claims, but not the state claims. Okay. That seems plausible to me. Like, I think that's like, okay, there is federal law in question. The man has timely removed it to federal court, essentially. So they will hear the federal claims. I think A is certainly plausible. B, it will hear the entire case because it was timely removed and involves a federal question. Okay. All right. I think I see the issue here. So sounds like a question of what does the federal court want to do when you've got both state and federal questions? You know, we can assume that the man, because I know that you are the master of your own complaint or something, or you get to decide. So I think it's okay that the man has the decision to file it in either court. And I think because he like removed it to federal court, I think that's okay. I'm pretty sure you can do that, I believe. And the attorney in the question agrees with me that you can remove to federal court. So I think that seems okay. But the question is, when you allege claims for both state and federal law, and you're in federal court, what does the federal court do? Do they answer both questions? I think that's the difference between A and B. A would say, all right, we'll take your case, but we're only looking at the federal law. B would say, we'll hear the entire case because it was timely removed. And I might be leaning more toward B, and I'll say why in a minute, I think. Let's see. C, I think the amount in controversy is a red herring, but God, I could be wrong on that. It will remand it and let, no, because I think it's a federal question. I think we're going, I am sticking to my guns. I don't think 75,000 matters. D, it will remand the case to state court. Now that D would be under the idea that there is, you can't, I don't know what, like the federal court won't look at the federal question for some reason. I can imagine D being the answer, and Andrew will tell me that it's like, well, you see, courts are overworked and so if there's a possibility of the state court to answer the do it, you know, then the state court does. I don't know though. I think you're allowed to do this. I'm leaning away from D. I'm going to do the bold thing that Andrew likes me to do. Even I don't know why. Just doesn't seem like it helps me or anything or is good. But I'm between A and B. I think D is certainly a possibility. C is right out. No, but D. I don't like D. I think D would be, well, I guess the other logic of D would be that the man's boss makes the motion to remand to state court. And for some reason, the person you're suing like gets the final say, but that's not right. I think we know it's not that. It's the opposite of that, I believe. I'm between A and B. So will the federal court hear the federal claims, but not the state claims? Or will it hear the entire case because it was timely removed and involves a federal question? I think I'm going to answer B. We're there anyway. We're already here, you know, and the federal courts, as I think I've experienced in other questions, do have the ability to rule on state stuff, you know, like different states' laws. I think we've talked about that. I think they have to when it's a diversity jurisdiction thing, because we're only talking about state law in that case, right? So they have the ability. I think the principle would be like, if you're here anyway, you know, you're not gonna have to do a separate suit and all that for state. So I'm gonna go with B. Not much confidence in this one, but we'll see. We'll see. B, final answer.
All right. And if you'd like to play along with Thomas, you know how to do that. Just share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons on patreon.com/law. Enjoying, by the way, that Lot Awful movie is coming at you very soon. Boy, I have a lot of editing to do. As soon as I can finish it, but I'm on it. Don't worry, I'm working on it. And of course, ad-free episodes, each and every episode, all the goodies. Why don't you thank our new patrons? Start us off, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you to Sad Panda, Ryan H., Damian Doherty, Teddy Siegel, Willard Wonka and the Policy Factory. Love that. And Mike Bloom. Thomas, take it away.
Thank you to Bren Sheenan, Michael Grusniklaus, Flashy Amoeba, Matt Leonberger, Elijah Luna, and Shahzad Rizvi. Thank you so much, new patrons. We hope you enjoy the perks, and we really appreciate your support. It's how we do the show. So thank you so much. And that's our show, Andrew. Wow, you've got me cautiously optimistic on this Voting Rights Act. I mean, that would be so huge. You know, I'll be honest, I've been a little down on what I think the future of the country is, but that would really do a lot. So I hope the optimistic Optimus Prime over here is correct on this one.
Me too.
All right, we'll see you next time.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it will be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community, Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.